Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jody Backlund from Olympia, representing Andrew Toombs this morning. I would like to reserve 5 minutes. I don't know who does the clock.
I do.
You do. Okay. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. As you may recall, Mr. Toombs was convicted of several crimes out of an incident outside of the Fife municipal offices. We've raised several issues, one of which has been conceded by the state. Unless there are questions as to that issue, what I would like to focus on today are our arguments relating to insufficient evidence. We have several arguments with respect to insufficient evidence. First, there were two assault three charges, one against a probation worker and one against a security worker, both of which were insufficient as there was no proof of an actual assault. The state's evidence as to both of these charges was at best that Mr. Toombs assumed what is called, what the police officers here called repeatedly, a fighting stance. He had his legs separated with one in front of the other. He had his arms at his sides with his hands and fists possibly raised up to his waist, possibly lower. He did not move forward once he took that position. He did not reach out or attempt to strike anyone once he took that position. He was several feet away. He was yelling at the officer. The officers were coming. He was yelling also at the city workers. But he did not strike out or make any attempts to strike out at either man. Once he took this position, as I said, he did not move forward. The officers who saw it all indicated that their fear was an assault could occur, that someone could get hurt, that they called it a pre-assaultive stance or a pre-fight stance. This is all possibly true, but not an actual assault or a threat of an actual assault.
So is it your position that he was clearly angry, he was clearly upset?
Yes.
He had taken an aggressive posture?
Could be defensive also, but he had taken the posture as I described.
Move forward.
Yes.
And he's saying things that are somewhat hostile.
Yeah, very hostile.
Your position is that's not enough to.
That's not an assault. It's speaking hostily. It's yelling inappropriately at city workers that you want help from. It's
taking. Would that not be a manifestation of an intent to cause a reasonable apprehension of or fear of bodily injury?
Well, I don't think it is. I think taking that position, that's a position people take. It's not an assault. It could be pre-assaultive. And for police to become involved is not necessarily the issue that we're arguing, but whether or not that constitutes in and of itself, without forward movement, without striking movement, without being close enough to actually make contact, he was still, once he took that stance, and we believe that it takes further action to make it into an actual assault.
What if the action is perceived by the other person as a reasonable apprehension of fear that they are going to be injured or touched?
All of the people involved here were either law enforcement or involved in law enforcement in some ways. And so the right and ability they have to take some action is different than a citizen. So perceiving a threat may be something that wouldn't necessarily amount to an assault.
So do we take it from the reasonable police officer, or is it a reasonable person?
I think it's a reasonable person. And so what I'm saying is that regardless of what these particular officers saw, it is not a subjective standard. It is an assault. It is not whether or not I thought he would assault me, but whether or not an assault occurred. Here, the convictions were for assault, not attempted assault, not preparing for an assault. They were an actual assault. And given that he took this stance, which I don't have any problem with people concluding that it looks aggressive. Looking aggressive doesn't mean you have assaulted someone. It means, I guess, that you could in the future, but that's a future action that was never taken here. Mr. Toombs did not actually commit an assault. He looked like he might in the future, but he never did. As I said, that stance can be consistent with self-defense as well as offense, and you can't know which wasn't.
You want to move to the intimidating a public servant?
Okay. With respect to intimidating a public servant, our argument is that conviction would require an attempt to influence the action of a public servant as part of their official duties. What happened here is the security worker was leaving. It's not a uniformed officer, not an officer at all, but a person who had timed out, done for the day in the parking lot going to his car or leaving.
That he worked at the front desk?
Yep.
And isn't one of his functions, part of his job is they come to the front desk, they ask for, can I speak to Officer so-and-so, and he goes and gets Officer so-and-so?
Yes, but he's not at the front desk when this happened. And so regardless of what his duties would have been, were he at work, he wasn't at work. He was a person walking through the parking lot.
You have used your opening time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Proctor from the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office, asking this court to affirm the convictions below, except for the one count of felony harassment that we concede did not have proper unity, jury unanimity to sustain that conviction. I was not planning on spending a lot of time on the sufficiency of the evidence test issues this morning, unless the court has questions of me. I would point out that the jury was instructed, as it usually is in criminal cases, with the three common law definitions of assault, and clearly the evidence here supported either that it was an assault done with intent to inflict bodily injury but failing to accomplish it. He raised his arms into clenched fists. He was standing.
Well, when you say raised his arms, I thought the evidence was they were like waist high.
Well, you can punch somebody in the stomach with a waist high fist. And I have the cite from a Supreme Court case dating back to 1910 that talks about that raising the hand in anger with an apparent purpose to strike and sufficiently near to enable the purpose to be carried into effect. It doesn't actually require that you move the fist forward, and we have
didn't
that here.
Didn't they also discuss in that case, if you've got a weapon in your hand or if you actually move forward as if to strike, and do we have any of that here?
No, you don't have a weapon in your hand. You do have him taking the standing position. You have him being in very close proximity to his victims, using threatening language, and both were put in fear that they both thought I was going to be physically assaulted, which also would meet the definition of trying to create apprehension and fear. And
we're pretty close to a line here, aren't we, of clenching your fists as criminal?
Well, I think that this is where we come down to the test involved here, which is you're to look at the light most favorable to the state in this case. The jury heard this evidence. They heard it from the witnesses, from the two men who were there, who were put in fear.
But if you look at it in the light most favorable to the state, that means that the state is authorized to bring criminal charges against people who clench their fists.
Well, they don't just have to clench their fists. They have to be close.
With someone.
They have to be close enough to actually inflict the blow. If there was a sufficient distances between these two people that the fist would not cross that distance,
I mean, he was 5 or 6 feet away. Wouldn't he have to step closer if he was actually going to strike a blow?
I think there's varying degrees about how far they were apart, and there's testimony that they was close enough to strike the blow. So that, again, is, I think, a jury issue about whether they were close enough below. But
Are you aware of any case where the actual physical aggression or the physical acts were as minimal as they are in this case, and the court sustained an assault charge?
It's hard to say. I can find no case where they talk about it in those terms. I can also point out that 20 years ago, sufficiency of the evidence discussions and cases were often, we have reviewed the evidence and we find it sufficient, and you didn't get a lot of detailed discussions about that, laying it out bit by bit. So I have never found a case, though, that says that if you raise your hand, you must move it forward before it is an assault. There is the case that says raising the hand and clenching the fist is sufficient. So when we talk about that, I would suppose that Hal B. Winters talks about that being sufficient to meet that definition of assault, as long as you have that proximity to the person.
Was there a first aggressor instruction given in this case? I can't recall.
I do not believe that there was.
Okay.
Do you have in mind a case decided after State versus Green adopted the Jackson versus Virginia standard in Washington, the facts of which you think support your argument on the assault?
Well, I'm not sure why that change in the law. I look at the change.
Why don't you answer my question first,
and then you can
evaluate the merit of the question.
Well, I do not. But in generally, I think that...
Well, then the merit of the question comes from this. The whole reason that State versus Green is a notable case is because it announced that Washington had been applying an unconstitutional standard for sufficiency of the evidence since statehood. That's the significance of State versus Green. So the utility of cases that are sufficiency of the evidence cases that are decided before State versus Green is questionable. The discussion seems to be focusing on cases that were decided under a less demanding standard than State versus Green, and it's questionable whether they would still be authoritative or would warrant our consideration. So that's why I wanted to give you the opportunity. It's been 36 years, 37 years since State versus Green was decided. Is there a case with the facts you think the facts of the case are sufficiently similar to this, decided under the proper constitutional standard that supports your point of view?
I don't think that this changes the authority of what my case cites beforehand. Excuse me, just a minute. The case that I cite is talking about what satisfies the common law definition of assault. It's a tort definition, but it was used in torts as well as in criminal case about what satisfies the common law definition of assault. That is not affected by the change in the standard by the Jackson v. Virginia or the State v. Green case. That's talking about what is sufficient to do that. So there you're talking about what is the legal standard that you're measuring the evidence against the standard. And so that does not affect the analysis, in my opinion, of the sufficiency of the evidence case here. And Jackson v. Virginia changed it in a number of ways. I mean, we used to have in this state, if you're, you know, that all the circumstances had to be taken kind of in the light most favorable to the defendant, and that changed under that, and we don't do that anymore. So I do not believe that the fact that we had that change in the sufficiency of the evidence standard affects my argument one bit. The question is does this state look at that act as being sufficient to meet the common law definition, and that has not changed. I would like to just take a moment to discuss the issue about the motion to dismiss for the delay in getting the defendant out to Western State Hospital. And I would point out that there is one, it's unclear to me exactly the legal argument that was being made in the trial court for the basis of dismissal. On appeal, they're relying upon the True Blood decision and Oregon versus Mink. Those cases involve civil actions in federal court against the, what I would call the treatment agency, in this case it's DSHS and the equivalent factor down in Oregon, or the equivalent agency down in Oregon. And they find that there's a substantive due process violation if there is a delay in transport. But the test for finding a substantive due process test is to balance the individual interest in liberty against the government's asserted reasons for restraint of individual liberty. Those cases have never weighed and balanced a prosecutorial agency's interest in that. They've only looked at the treatment agencies of that. So I don't think that you can take those case law and just pick them up and move them over into the criminal case. And
what
say,
do you think, then, is the proper remedy, or what is the correct analogy?
Well, I think you have to weigh it. We have an interest in pursuing our prosecution of criminal acts. Obviously, we have no interest in pursuing them against an incompetent person, but we do have a right to maintain to see if that person can be restored to competency and to prosecute them afterwards if they can. So there may be, I mean, this defendant may have a right to have some damages in a civil action before the delay that was done there, but the question is that a dismissal of the case, and what's the authority for that? When we're also talking about individual liberty, you also have the overlay of a bail situation, which was really not explored or talked about or discussed in this case. A person could be restrained from a bail restriction and then be ordered out to have competency restored. And his liberty there's two things going on in effect. One is the issues having to do with his competency, and the second have to do with whether he can make his bail or not. And they're acting independently of one another. So his liberty is restrained by two different actions going on there. And that makes it complicated. And that's why
I'm trying to follow the analogy here. Are you saying in a situation where he was unable to make bail for, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Financially unable or when the court wouldn't set bail?
Unable to make bail. What I'm saying is that a person's restraint on liberty might be affected by a bail decision. not just an order to have competency restored. So when you're balancing,
well, I mean, a person's liberty can be affected by all kinds of things, but I guess the situation here is that this person was supposed to get into the hospital sooner.
And, absolutely.
And there's some responsibility here on the part of the state. Maybe, I don't know to what extent that comes down to the Pierce County prosecutor, but does it ever come down to anybody? I mean, you know, in terms of a criminal case, does the state's interest, as you have expressed it, in prosecuting people for crimes ever is it ever subjected to a limitation based on the state's inability to properly handle people who are incompetent?
It might be. I mean, I think the point is the court never here found the DSHS in contempt and didn't find a basis for dismissing the charges. And I would say that was the proper decision in the facts of this case.
Thank you.
So in the state's brief, they indicate that Mr. Toombs was a few feet away. My notes from reading the transcript say 5 to 6 feet. My brief, I say several. So in any event, everybody who talked about it, and I mean the officers who testified, my brief, the state's brief, everybody's brief, when the police officers made physical contact with Mr. Toombs, everybody said moved in. They didn't say reached out. They didn't say grabbed. They said moved in. And I think all of those things together.
Who moved in, Mr. Toombs?
The police moved in to arrest Mr. Toombs.
I see.
And all of those things together, I think, support our position that he was standing still far enough away that he could not simply reach out and make contact, that he did not move forward, and that there's no evidence whatsoever to support the theory that he could have reached out and made contact this close. If the police officers needed to move in, if we all agree that 5 to 6 feet could be either a few or several, he was not able to make contact. And again, our argument is the same, which is it could have been a pre-assaultive stance, but taking a pre-assaultive stance does not ripen into an assault until an assault occurs or is attempted. He did not raise his fist or make any threatening gestures other than to take the stance. So to take these facts and to then create the ability for that, simply taking those actions, taking that position and being very, very angry and saying very hostile things, those should not be considered an assault. I want to talk a little bit about...
Was it sufficient to indicate a threat for purposes of the intimidating charge?
For purposes of the intimidating charge, there were verbalizations that could have been a threat that Mr. Toombs was making, but not assaults, but verbalizations that could have been considered a threat. I mean, the issue with respect to the intimidating a public servant is, what official action was he trying to make the security worker take? And our position is that there's no official action. He's asking for a common courtesy of, hey, could you get a message to someone? He's not saying it very nicely, but it's not an official action. After Van Zanten had...
The definition of an official action is someone who's acting in the scope of what they're employed to do.
That could be the definition. I have no problem with that definition, yes.
Wasn't he acting within the scope of what he was employed to do?
No, because he was not working, and there was no official decision that he was being asked to make. So the other issue is we use the same facts to support our other argument with respect to insufficient evidence with respect to Mr. Van Zanten, and that is that he was not performing official duties at the time of his interaction with Mr. Toombs. So even if you agree, which we don't think you should, that there is sufficient evidence for an assault in that case with respect to Van Zanten, that when he had that interaction with Mr. Toombs, he was not performing his official duties. He was walking to his car to go home. He had timed out for the night. He's not a police officer who can be said to be on duty at all times. And so those same facts, we believe, also support the argument that the evidence was insufficient for an assault. With respect to with respect to the felony harassment issue, assuming that the court accepts the state's concession with respect to the unanimity of the verdict, I need to just to be straight ahead, acknowledge that the case of Trey M. addresses very directly our second issue with respect to that. We can see that it does. In addition to reversing for insufficient evidence on the two assault charges and reversing for insufficient evidence as to the intimidating a public servant charge, we ask, and the state agrees, that the felony harassment conviction should be reversed. We also ask the court to remand for reparation of a clerical error so that the judgment and sentence can be accurately completed. With respect to the competency restoration, Your Honors, there aren't published cases directly on this point. We think there should be. We urge the court, through the authorities that we've cited in our brief, to put the responsibility where it lies. Mr. Toombs was in custody 2.5 months waiting for competency restoration. It is not his fault that he is not able to make bail. He suffers from mental illness and disability. And those things combined to unfairly violate his right to substantive due process. Thank you.
Thank you.